It's TechBiter Worldwide with Bill Blinn. The latest on programs and policies, helpful hints, and a bit of occasional nonsense. All in more or less plain English.
Podcast number 886 for the 14th of June, 2024. This week, despite having used CrashPlan for the last 8 years and still feeling that it is a viable online backup service, I have switched to Backblaze. In short circuits, starting in less than 2 weeks, Facebook will begin using your public posts, photos, and chatbot iterations to train its AI. And libraries are among my favorite institutions because of their high-tech and low-tech solutions to today's problems. Backup, as I've mentioned occasionally, is absolutely essential, and one of the more important features of any backup system is versioning. Let's explore what versioning is, and I'll explain why I've migrated from CrashPlan, which I've used since April 2016, to Backblaze. Versioning is what makes it possible for a user to open an earlier version of a file if the latest version has been damaged by malware or modified accidentally by the user, or if there's simply some other reason that the earlier copy of the file is preferable to the latest copy. When I back up files to disk drives that are stored locally using GoodSync, files from the computer are duplicated on another disk drive. The most essential working files are backed up once a day, and all files are backed up once a week. But there's only one copy, and it's stored locally. If I need an earlier copy, I won't find it there, and I need an online backup system because those backups are stored off-site. So that's why online backup systems such as CrashPlan or Backblaze are essential. First, they continuously back up files as they're modified. If a file is damaged at 1:30 in the afternoon, but I know it was okay at 9 o'clock in the morning, I can check to see if there are any additional versions on backup and recover the latest good version. Or maybe I opened a file in January, used it as a starting point for a new document, then forgot to save it using a new name. Now it's June and I'd like to use the January version again. Ah, versioned backup will have it. Both CrashPlan and Backblaze offer that feature. The annual cost is about the same, so you're wondering why I have migrated from one to the other. First and most important is this. I do not recommend against CrashPlan. It is an excellent service, and it worked well for me until it didn't. The problem I encountered is rare. Most users will see it rarely, if they ever see it. It was only when the problem began to occur every few days instead of every few months, and CrashPlan support was unable to resolve the issue despite several weeks of intense ongoing efforts by them, that I looked for an alternative. CrashPlan's user interface is somewhat better than what Backblaze offers, and CrashPlan's include-exclude filtering is far better, much easier to use. But Backblaze has run without failure or interruption since I installed it. So doubtless you're wondering what the problem was. The user interface began losing its connection with the background service. Usually backups continued normally, and this affected only my ability to observe the status of the operation, but in some cases I was logged out by authority, and this did halt the continuous backup process. To regain control in either case required restarting the computer, sometimes several times, and manually logging in. After rebooting, the connection process was still somewhat unreliable. After logging in successfully and seeing a sign-in successful message, CrashPlan sometimes would report unable to sign in, unknown error. Sometimes repeating the login process cleared the error. In other cases, I had to restart the computer yet again. Reliability suffered, and I was spending far too much time working with support to identify the root cause and fix it. I uninstalled and reinstalled the application, modified ownership and permissions for certain directories used by CrashPlan, provided lots of logs, and provided several other tests, some of which seemed to work for a day or two, and then didn't. So let me say this again. This is a problem most users will never see, or if they do see it, it'll be maybe once or twice a year. In my case, clearly some weird edge condition, the disruptions were occurring at least twice a week, sometimes more frequently. Getting Backblaze up and running took only a few minutes. After downloading and installing the application, I started a 15-day free trial. Then I selected the drives to be backed up. As is the case with CrashPlan, the Windows directories cannot be backed up. The initial backup process may take several weeks. It depends on how many files you have and how large they are. I have a lot of photo files, a lot of video files, so the process took nearly 2 weeks. Backblaze starts by uploading the smallest files first. That makes a lot of sense because small files are more likely to be recently changed data files. When it encounters files that exceed 100 megabytes in size, the files are divided into 10 megabyte chunks that are then reassembled on the server. During the initial setup, you'll see an exclusions tab that shows extensions of files that will not be backed up. These are typically operating system files that change constantly. You can also add folders to be skipped, and this is where Backblaze suffers badly by comparison to CrashPlan. No drive letters are associated with exclusions. If you have two directories with identical names on different drives and you want to back up one but not the other, you'll have to rename one of them. That's a silly oversight, and I hope the developers will sort it out eventually, but it's certainly not a showstopper. Overall, the user interface appears to be badly dated, much like something from the late 1990s, so really the entire UI should be scheduled for a full makeover. The Reports tab shows the full size of your backup and the space consumed by each type of file. Before the full initial backup completed, I did try restoring a couple of files just to make sure everything was working properly. Backblaze comes with a restore app where the user selects the date of the file to restore. In most cases, it'll be the most recent backup, unless you're looking for an earlier version. Then drill down to the drive and folder that contains the file or files that you want. Place check marks beside any files you want to recover, and choose whether you want them to be placed in a specific folder or to be restored to the original location. And you can also specify whether you should skip any files that exist or overwrite them. When the restore operation is complete, and it was surprisingly quick, you'll see a summary. Once again, and for the record, even though I have switched to Backblaze and do recommend it, I can still recommend CrashPlan without reservation for most users. You'll find links to both Backblaze and CrashPlan on the TechBiter Worldwide website, www.techbiter.com. If you find these podcasts useful, and I hope you do, might you consider a donation? There are no ads here, and support from listeners is the sole source of income. It's easy. Just visit the website and click the donate button near the top of any page. You can make a one-time donation or schedule a repeating donation every month. I thank you. And so does the cat. In Short Circuits, a bit less than 2 weeks from now, on the 26th of June, 2024, the never-ending series of modifications to Facebook's or Meta's privacy policies will expand again. Unless you have been unconscious for the past year or so, you know that artificial intelligence, or AI, is a big thing, and it's being added to everything from computer programs and automobiles to running shoes and cornflakes. All right, maybe not cornflakes, but it's not from lack of effort by the marketing departments. When Post, Kellogg, or General Mills marketers figure out a way to mention AI and cornflakes in the same sentence, they will. Anyway, as of June 26th, Facebook will allow itself to use your publicly posted texts and images to train its AI creative tool. This applies only to your public posts and not to any private messages. If you want a more precise summary of what Facebook can use to train its AI, here it is. Any public posts on Facebook, including photos and captions, as well as any messages to Facebook's AI chatbots. And if you'd like an even more detailed explanation, one that could take you well over an hour to read, see Meta's full privacy policy. There's a link to it on the TechBiter Worldwide website. Keep in mind that there is no reasonable expectation of privacy for any post you may make to Facebook or any other online resource, for that matter. It's difficult to make a case for posting words or images publicly and then being shocked and dismayed that they're being used publicly. If you don't want Facebook to use your data this way, you have this option. Stop using Facebook. Meta has established a process by which you can object, and you'll find that on a page entitled AI at Meta Data Subject Rights. There's a link to it on the TechBiter Worldwide website. You can use a form there to request permission to access, download, or correct any personal information from third parties that Meta says it uses to improve AI. You can also delete any personal information from third parties used for building and improving AI at Meta. Or you can register your concern about personal information from third parties that Meta is using. Now, you may have noticed that I used the word request. That's because Meta says, and I quote, "We don't automatically fulfill requests sent using this form. We review them consistent with your local laws." In other words, you probably won't receive a response unless you live in the European Union, where the general data protection regulations are in effect. So, as I said a while ago, if you don't want to participate in Facebook's AI building process, you have a single choice that involves not using Facebook. Have I mentioned libraries recently? Central Ohio has what I think are some truly exceptional libraries, from the 23 locations of the Columbus Metropolitan Library to smaller systems that have a few locations or just one. But a library probably serves your area, no matter where you live. The American Library Association says the United States has 16,607 library buildings, nearly 700 bookmobiles, more than 105,000 school libraries, and another 5,500 government armed forces and special libraries. That's according to the American Library Association. Ohioans seem to like libraries. None of the libraries in the state are in the top 25 by population served, but four libraries in the state are in the top 25 by number of items in their collections, and three are in the top 25 by circulation. By now, perhaps you're wondering what my point is here, and why. Okay, first, why? A friend showed me a screenshot of an article with the tagline, "Incredible maths proof is so complex that almost no one can explain it." And he said, "I can't access without a subscription, but thought you might be interested in tracking it down." Math has never been my strongest area, but I've always found it interesting. The article was in New Scientist, a British publication. As it turned out, my library offers access to magazines and newspapers via both Overdrive and PressReader. I checked Overdrive first and found that it had access to the current edition of New Scientist. So I borrowed it, and I read the article. And actually, that explains what my point is. If you haven't visited a library in the past several decades, you might be surprised by what's there. You may also be surprised by what you can borrow, even though it's not there. I borrow about 100 books each year from the library, but most of the books never leave the library and I never return them. They're e-books. After checking them out, I can read them in Adobe Digital Editions, Libby, or a browser. When the loan period expires, the book is returned automatically. Books, magazines, and newspapers are what a lot of people think about being able to bring home from a library, but my small-town library offered 16mm films and projectors in the 1960s. Today's libraries have CDs, DVDs, e-books, and access to online newspapers, magazines, and classes. Many have even more. You might find admission tickets to local attractions, binge boxes full of related movies, service code readers for cars, educational flashcards, chargers for various devices, computer mice, mobile hotspots, projectors. You name it, there's probably a library somewhere that has it. The ones I listed are all available from Worthington Libraries, and I've seen some libraries that even offer pots and pans. You're cooking something special, you need a specialized pot or a pan. Well, your library might have it. The Westerville Library offers art for your walls, guitars, and tools you can use for home projects. In Bexley, the public library has birding kits, telescopes, musical instruments, and board games. Some libraries allow patrons to print documents using an online connection and then picking them up when they're finished at the library. The Grandview Heights Public Library is one of several that offers free admissions to the Columbus Museum of Art, the Columbus Symphony, and the National Veterans Memorial Museum. The Central Library Consortium includes 17 member libraries in Central Ohio and share many of their holdings. A library card is about the most useful and valuable piece of plastic you can have in your wallet, and it's available for free. Libraries in some cities make cards available to all citizens of the state. The Los Angeles Public Library issues cards to any resident of California. That's not the case for Chicago, where you must be a resident of the city. The New York Public Library provides access to all residents of the state. In many cases, libraries limit out-of-area patrons to electronic media. Some, such as libraries in Brooklyn, Los Angeles County, San Diego, and Seattle, issue electronic cards to anyone age 13 to 21 who are unable to obtain a book that they want to read because it has been banned locally. So look around. Your local public library probably has a website. See what's available, and you can thank me later. Thanks for listening to TechBiter Worldwide. I'm Bill Blinn. There's more on the website, techbiter.com, and if you have a question or a comment, use the contact link you'll find there. Stop by again next week for another session.